This is VOA News. I'm David Byrd. The House of Representatives has voted to impeach President Donald Trump. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani has details on the historic vote.
He gave us no choice.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi opened a day-long debate by arguing Democrats were defending democracy against a president who violated the Constitution by abusing his power and obstructing Congress. But the impeachment process divided lawmakers like it divided the nation. Republicans like Arizona's Debbie Lesko argued Democrats are the ones committing abuses, targeting a president they simply don't like.
There is no proof, none, that the president has committed an impeachable offense.
The president himself called the impeachment effort an assault on America. He'll now face a trial in the GOP-led Senate, which is likely to acquit him. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
President Trump was not actually in Washington when the votes occurred. He was in the battleground state of Michigan, a state he won in 2016 for a political rally. The president told his supporters that he has done nothing wrong.
It's so much fun. They want to impeach you. They want to do worse than that. By the way, it doesn't really feel like we're being impeached, do you?
Only two previous presidents have been impeached in U.S. history. The House in 1998 impeached former President Bill Clinton on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice arising from a sexual relationship he had with a White House intern. He was later acquitted in the Senate. The House impeached President Andrew Johnson in 1868, but he was also acquitted by the Senate. In 1974, President Richard Nixon resigned before the full House could pass articles of impeachment against him. This is VOA News. A federal appeals court has ruled against the individual mandate in former President Obama's signature health care law. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has details.
A federal appeals court has ruled the individual mandate part of President Barack Obama's health care law is invalid. The 2-1 ruling was handed down by a panel of the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans. The panel upheld a 2018 finding by Texas-based U.S. District Judge Reed O'Connor that the so-called individual mandate requiring insurance was rendered unconstitutional when Congress reduced a tax on people without insurance to zero in 2017. The 5th Circuit panel did not issue a decision on whether other parts of the Affordable Care Act can be severed from the individual mandate and survive. I'm Mike Gracia.
India's top court on Wednesday refused to stall the implementation of a new law that lays out a path to citizenship for non-Muslim minorities from some neighboring countries. Francis McGuire reports the decision was made despite violent protests that continued across the country.
The Citizenship Amendment Act gives non-Muslim minorities from neighboring countries Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan a path to Indian citizenship. The government says the law was intended to address the persecution of religious minorities such as Hindus, Sikhs, and Christians in those Muslim-majority countries. But thousands have protested, saying the exclusion of Muslims from the law is anti-Islam and weakens the secular foundations of India. Some protesters believe it's a measure by the Hindu nationalist government to marginalize the community. Buses and train stations have been torched, and on Wednesday, police fired shots to push back thousands of demonstrators throwing stones and glass bottles. The Supreme Court said it would hear petitions challenging the constitutional validity of the law on January 22nd.
That's Francis McGuire of Reuters reporting. The bodies of two people missing and presumed dead since a New Zealand volcano erupted last week may never be found. Deputy Police Commissioner Mike Clement said Wednesday that he was deeply sorry that the bodies of local tour guide Hayden Marshall Inman and Australian tourist Winona Langford have not been recovered. He said that the bodies were probably swept out to sea. Clement said, the reality is we have to wait for Mother Nature to produce the bodies. It may and it may not. The White Island volcano erupted on December 9th while dozens of tourists were visiting the island. It's located about 48 kilometers off the coast of New Zealand's North Island. For more on these stories and the rest of the day's news, be sure to log on to voanews.com. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bati in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 19th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's capital is reported tense as a controversial activist plans to return home today, Thursday.
Areas where there were no checkpoints, there are now checkpoints, police checkpoints, immigration manned checkpoints, requesting citizen ID cards. It's extremely alarmingly conspicuous.
Zimbabwe's cabinet approves a constitutional amendment bill 2019. Unexploded mines pose threat to South Sudan farmers and villagers. Kenyans try feeding on problem cactus. And the first ever global refugee forum has ended with pledges worth billions of dollars.
It's difficult to add up these different type of contributions, but we want to monitor the implementation of these pledges all together, and we want to measure impact as soon as possible.
And the gorilla population in Uganda is said to be on the increase. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's capital, Monrovia, is said to be tense this morning as the country awaits the arrival from the United States of one of the controversial planners of a December 30 protest calling on President George Weah to step down for lack of good leadership. In a letter to the Council of Patriots, the group organizing the protest, Justice Minister Frank Musa Dean, earlier this month denied the group a permit to protest, saying such gathering calling is unconstitutional and bespeaks treason. Henry Costa, founder of the Council of Patriots, who has been living in the United States, says he will arrive in Liberia Thursday morning from Accra, Ghana. He says the government has deployed police checkpoints from the capital, Monrovia, to the international airport. Meanwhile, some supporters of Mr. Costa are threatening violence. One social media posting threatened to burn down the international airport and the homes of key ministers, including justice, finance, and state, if the government arrests Mr. Costa upon arrival. Costa spoke with us from Accra, Ghana.
Mr. Porter, it's quite visible. Areas where there were no checkpoints, there are now checkpoints, police checkpoints, immigration manned checkpoints, requesting citizen ID cards. It's extremely alarmingly conspicuous. And one of the things they've been doing is they've been removing tint from people's vehicles. And for security reasons, they've been putting checkpoints, and the city is just very tension-packed at the moment.
You want to have a protest on December 30th. The government has denied your permit to have a protest. Do you understand?
Yes, Mr. Borders, first of all, we don't need one. We don't need a permit as per our law. But the protest is not tomorrow, sir. Tomorrow is when I arrive, and I'm just an ordinary peaceful citizen returning home. What's the need for all the checkpoints? The increased police presence at the airport and the checkpoints on the highway, requesting citizens to show their citizens' ID card. What's the need for all of that, if not for my return home, sir? That's the question you need to be asking the Liberian authorities, Mr. Bonte. Of course, you always ask very tough questions, which is a good thing.
I read a number of things on social media, and this one seems to be from one of your supporters, say that you will be arriving in Liberia and that your supporters have deployed themselves strategically. They challenged the government to attempt to arrest you, and they've said other things I can say are provocative. I'm sure you probably have read some of this. Do you know that the government will arrest you?
The government had been saying all along that they would arrest me, Mr. Borte. And then the Minister of Justice capitulated on that statement and said that they would not arrest me. So I don't know what they would do tomorrow. But I know some of my supporters have been a little bit over the top with the rhetoric. I do not approve of some of the things that some of them have said. I'm a man of peace. I always pride myself on being a nonviolent person. And so I do not approve of some of the messages that have been posted on Facebook by my supporters in reaction to government threat to arrest me.
So what are you hearing from Liberia? Do you know if the Liberian government will allow you to come back home?
Well, the government does not have a credibility, and as such, you know, you have several functionaries of government saying different things. The Minister of Justice said I would not be arrested. Other officials of government said I would be arrested if I were to return home, and now I'm returning home tomorrow. So I cannot say definitively, sir, that I know for a fact what might happen tomorrow. So all these things are leading people to believe that the government will actually go ahead and carry out its threat to arrest me.
But what do you say to the government in power, to say that your planned protest for December 30th is simply intended to disrupt the peace of Liberia.
Those who say that have no grounds, because we organized the June 7th protest, Mr. Bonte, that you covered. It was the most peaceful protest in the history of the country. The international community, the American embassy, the European Union, everybody commended us for the peaceful conduct of the protest. So we intend to just emulate ourselves, our great example that we made on June 7th, sir. Nobody has any reason to be worried. When I get home, I will show the Liberian people that we will maintain the peace as we always have.
Your planned protest is calling for President George Weah to step down. I think the justice minister has even referred to some of that as treasonous. So do you understand the purpose behind heightened security in Liberia?
Sir, peaceful protest has never caused war in any country. Peaceful protest is not treasonous. What is treasonous, Mr. Bauti, is when the president a few days ago wrote a letter to the Liberian legislature requesting them to grant him authorization to infuse $4 billion Liberian dollars. That's treasonous, a violation of the Constitution, Article 34D. Where did he get that money from? What is treasonous, Mr. Bauti, is when the president nominates the ambassador to the United States and does not send him for Senate confirmation and goes ahead and commissions him and dispatches him off to the U.S. That is treason. But us calling for a peaceful protest to say to the president, please step down, without actually enforcing that beyond merely calling for that, is not treasonous, sir. We know the confines of the law and we are operating within the confines of the law. We will do no more than simply say, step down. We will not throw stones. We will not barricade the executive mansion. We will only assemble and say in a very loud voice, step down, Mr. President, for the sake of our country.
Henry Costa is the founder of the Council of Patriots, organizers of the coming December 30 protest in Liberia. He was speaking with us from Accra, Ghana. Liberian Information Minister Eugene Nabwe sent us a text message Wednesday night saying the security situation was under control and that what he called the disruptors of peace will not be allowed. Zimbabwe's cabinet has approved a constitutional amendment, Bill 2019, allowing the president-elect to appoint two vice presidents. The amendment, among other things, also allows for the appointment of judges of the Constitutional Court for a non-renewable term of not more than 15 years. Here to discuss the amendment is Taba Nari, a Zimbabwean who works with civil society groups in Zimbabwe.
The bill essentially says that the Constitution of Zimbabwe will be amended, and in getting it amended, what it does is that we had a running mate provision where whoever was a presidential candidate would choose someone as a running mate. And the assumption was that that person, if the president would resign or the president would not be fit for office, that vice president could then act in the office of the president and even run himself to become president. But what cabinet has done is that it has taken the powers for that and it has given those powers to the president. So the president is the one who is now going to appoint two vice presidents.
So that means that the president can fire the vice president?
Yes, the president can fire the vice president. And the feeling among some of the Zimbabwean thinkers and scholars is that basically what's happening is that ZANU-PF, which is the ruling party currently, is solving its succession policies using the Constitution of Zimbabwe. So ZANU-PF as a party, they do not have, you know, elections for their president. They have this process whereby eventually you get a president by popular acclamation. They have never been an election within the party for a president.
It does not say anything about the presidential term limits. It doesn't say that.
Currently, we have two term limits. A president may serve for two terms. But again, they have said through their party that they're even intending to change the term limits. So instead of implementing the current constitution, implementing the political reforms to take Zimbabwe out of the crisis that it is, they've come up with something, you know, that takes Zimbabwe further back.
It says something also about the age at which judges of the High Court can stay in power.
So basically, we have a Chief Justice who presided over the electoral case where Mr. Nelson Chamisa, who was reported to have won, that case he lost it, and Mr. Mnangagwa was declared as the winner. So that Chief Justice is due to retire. And what they have done basically is they said a chief justice and the judges can serve up for up to 70 years. So previously at 65, someone would be due for retirement, but now they can saying they can serve until they are at the age of 70. And after the age of 70, if they have a medical fitness certificate, their contract can be renewed annually for up to 5 years.
Tabang Nairi is a Zimbabwean who works with civil society groups in Zimbabwe. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Dallas in Texas. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 19. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Since 2004, the United Nations has destroyed over a million explosive devices in South Sudan, including landmines and cluster munitions scattered across the region from decades of conflict. The United Nations Mine Action Service says the unexploded ordnance poses a threat to farmers and villagers, but they expect to clear the remaining explosives within 6 years. Sheila Pony has details from Magua County in South Sudan.
Mary Moyoyo Joseph was collecting tall grass near their village a year ago to cover the roof of her home when she stepped on a landmine. I had no idea there was something there. I only remember a dull sound, like dim. And the next thing I remember was being on the ground in terrible pain. Mary Joseph is one of more than 3,500 people in South Sudan who have lost limbs or have been injured by unexploded ordnance since the demining began 15 years ago, and nearly 1,400 have been killed. The United Nations Mine Action Service, UNMAS, has now reduced that explosive threat down to 27 square kilometers of land across South Sudan. That represents progress of the 1,800 minefields recorded. There are only 184 left to clear, along with 128 non-cluster munition strikes. But Richard Bolter, the program manager for UNMAS in South Sudan, says it is tedious, time-consuming work.
The minimum metal mines have minimum metal in them, which means we have to investigate every single piece of metal as we're clearing the ground. So it's a slow process. The average deminer clears 20 square meters in a day. That's an area 4 meters by 5 meters, not much bigger than a single room.
Despite the challenge, UNMIS expects to clear all remaining minefields, cluster munition strikes and battlefields within 6 years by 2026. However, the head of South Sudan's National Mine Action Agency, Jorchuk Barach Jorchuk, says to accomplish that, villagers need to play a part when they find any suspected explosives.
The mine action business is not only for those who are working in it. It's a collective responsibility for the nationals, citizens, have to report whatever they see.
UNMIS cautions that even after all the known minefields and battlefields are cleared in South Sudan, it could take years, even decades, to find and eliminate remnants of yet undiscovered explosives. But every landmine or explosive they destroy means one less possible casualty from this deadly legacy of conflict. Sheila Pony for VOA News, Magui County, South Sudan.
The first ever global refugee forum has ended with more than 770 pledges worth billions of dollars in financial, technical, material, legal, and other assistance in support of millions of refugees and the communities that host them. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the site of the forum in Geneva.
The biggest single contribution came from the World Bank, which pledged $2.2 billion. This was matched by pledges of more than $3 billion in additional resources by states and $250 million from private corporations. However, the total value of the pledges made at the forum will not be known for some time. This is because many of the contributions come in the form of projects run by corporations, aid agencies, civic, faith-based, and other organizations. organizations. Many involve beneficial projects for refugees by creating jobs and livelihoods, enhancing employment for women, educational opportunities for children, pro bono legal services, and the like.
It's difficult to add up these different type of contributions, but we want to monitor the implementation of these pledges all together, and we want to measure impact as soon as possible. We have developed with member states a set of indicators that will give us progressively a sense of how much the pledges made around this forum have an impact.
More than 3,000 people, including heads of state, UN leaders, senior officials from international institutions, development organizations, and the private sector, attended the forum. About 80 refugees from 22 countries living in 30 countries of exile also participated. Their presence, testimonies, and stories of suffering and endurance put a human face on the cold statistics that accompany refugee numbers. The aim of the three-day meeting was to generate new approaches and long-term commitments in support of the world's 25 million refugees. Grandi says the burden of caring for these refugees falls mainly on the poor countries. He says the forum pushed the message that this responsibility must be shared by the rich countries.
We cannot go to a world in which responsibility sharing means some states keep all the refugees and some states pay all the money. We cannot do that. That's why we have resettlement. That's why we have different type of partnership. That's why asylum has to remain in reality in all parts of the world, including in the rich countries.
Grandi says the success of this forum will be measured by the number of pledges that are kept and implemented. He says he believes the enthusiasm and creativity shown by the participants augurs well. He says this is all the makings for a successful outcome. He notes a second global refugee forum will take place in 4 years' time. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Kenya, the Opuntia cactus, also known as the prickly pear, is spreading, destroying thousands of hectares of grassland and sickening animals that eat it. Kenyans have come up with a variety of methods to try to eradicate the problem plant, including breeding a microorganism to feed on the cactus and turn it into food for humans. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Ipole, Kenya.
59-year-old Margaret Mamai is fighting to free her land, not from human invaders, but the Opuntia cactus, a spiky plant. She says the plant has destroyed her livelihood. If goats eat the cactus and its fruits, their eyes and mouth are affected, she says. The most affected one is sheep. If it eats the cactus, there is no treatment, it dies. Now, there is no place for them to graze. People like Mamai have tried uprooting and burning the plants to no avail. In central Kenya, Philip Larpei, a community leader in El Poloi, says people are being driven from their homes. Many people have moved out because their goats and cattle are dying, Larpei says. The people of El Poloi and Minishoi, they are fleeing to other places. Many have left, he says. The Opuntia cactus has spread like a weed, killing thousands of hectares of grassland. Mamai is fighting back by breeding microorganisms that feed on the cactus. The Laikipia Permaculture Center is also fighting the cactus by crushing its fruits to make juice and wine. The seeds are dried and the oil is extracted for cosmetics.
The health of human beings is good. The only problem is for the animals, the spines. It's stuck in the animals. But for the juice and the fruit, you can also eat the fruit. Good for human use.
Kenyan authorities say the breeding of insects has been somewhat successful, but according to the Fanel Mosango of Kenya's Environment Agency, they need laboratories to produce large quantities required to wipe out the plant.
That's what we are lacking, to produce those microorganisms so that they can be spread all over for them to reduce the point. But it's a very slow method.
Slow or fast, ranchers like Mamai want to see the Opuntia destroyed before it ruins more farms and communities. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, El Poloi, Kenya.
A new gorilla census says there has been an increase in the population of gorillas. The 2018 census posts the population of gorillas in Bwindi, impenetrable national park in Uganda and neighboring Sarambwe in Democratic Republic of Congo at 459 from around 400 in 2011. Mugumi Davis Rakarinji reports from Kampala, Uganda.
While releasing the results of the gorilla census in Kampala this Monday, Sam Wondha, the executive director of Uganda Wildlife Authority, attributed the increase to better conservation practices.
We have 50 gorilla groups and we have 459 gorillas in those groups with 13 gorillas solitary. This is the minimum number. You need to emphasize that it's minimum because they were clearly identified and yet it is possible that some of them were missed.
This means that Buindi impenetrable forest is home to over 50% of these endangered species. Others live mainly in Mogahinga Gorilla National Park in Uganda, Rwanda's Volcano National Park, and Virunga National Park in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Professor Ephraim Kamuntu, Uganda's Minister of Tourism, Wildlife and Antiquities, welcomed the report. He said gorillas play a big role in attracting tourists in Uganda.
This is a big push in our effort to show the world that we are conserving for generation, we are conserving for humanity, we deserve support because our tourism is nature-based. For us, protect nature, which is also in our constitution, in our culture, and in our religion, is good economics, is good politics, is also good social relationship.
Kamont said, apart from gorillas, there's been significant increase in numbers of other animals in the country, such as elephants, buffaloes, and other apes. But he says this usually yields to people-animal conflicts.
We become victims of our success because these animals are increasing and the population of human beings is also increasing. But land is fixed. You find yourself, you are in a trap.
Conservationist Gladys Zikusoka agrees, but she says the government must not relent in its effort to protect mountain gorillas.
All the efforts that are being done to conserve gorillas, law enforcement to remove snares from the forest, improve veterinary care whenever any falls sick, improve monitoring of them through research, and also community engagement is very, very, very important. So that if a gorilla goes on somebody's garden, they don't kill it now, they call the people to safely chase it back because they're benefiting from the gorilla.
Tourism is one of the biggest sources of employment in Uganda. In 2018, the tourism sector generated some 1 million jobs for the country. According to the Uganda Bureau of Statistics, Uganda received over 1.5 million tourists in 2018, thus generating at least $1.4 billion for Uganda's economy. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Liberia's capital, Monrovia, is said to be tense this morning as the country awaits the arrival from the United States of one of the controversial planners of a December 30 protest calling on President George Weah to step down for lack of good leadership. In a letter to the Council of Patriots, the group organizing the protest, Justice Minister Frank Musa Dean, earlier this month denied the group a permit to protest, saying such gathering is unconstitutional and bespeaks treason. Henry Costa, the founder of the Council of Patriots, who has been living in the United States, says he will arrive in Liberia Thursday morning from Accra, Ghana. And that is it for this Thursday, December 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Nana Kuneido Ajeman Rawlings, the former First Lady of Ghana, reflects on the importance of empowering others and using public office to serve Ghanaian citizens. Nana Kuneido Ajeman Rawlings on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
It's summertime in the Southern Hemisphere, but if you're north of the equator, Border Crossings will bring you some warmth with our Psychedelic Sunshine Show. You'll hear from the best Californian musicians of the 60s, like Sonny and Cher, the Monkees, and the Beach Boys. Tune into Border Crossings on December 19th for the grooviest songs in the world, only on The Voice of America.